Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
You're on Team Human, Conscious Intervention in the Machine. An opportunity to find the others, establish rapport, and build the solidarity we need to reclaim reality for living, breathing, conspiring Earthlings. I'm Douglas Rushkoff, and I'm on Team Human, and so are you. Playing for Team Human today, solidarity activists Leah Hunt Hendricks and Astra Taylor.
I mean, even the name of your podcast, Team Human, implies a team anti-human, right? What that team anti-human is doing, in our view, is trying to divide and conquer. That's the phrase Leah used. We use it a lot in the book. Trying to separate us, pit us against each other in order for a minority of people to accumulate unjust and obscene power and profit.
Leah and Astra will be sharing ways to reclaim the power of collective action from their new book, Solidarity, The Past, Present, and Future of a World-Changing Idea. It's time to get our shit together, reject the divisive tactics of those in power, and find each other for real, once and for all. I'm Douglas Rushkoff, and we're all on Team Human. Astra Taylor has been my go-to activist and intellectual since long before Occupy Wall Street and the rolling debt jubilee she helped create. She's always been great at articulating what we intuitively feel as activists working together toward mutual aid, and backed it with both historical sweep and tactical grounding. I'd never met her writing partner, Occupy veteran and Hunt heiress, Leah Hunt Hendricks, founder of Solidaire, a network of progressives committed to funding movements focusing on racial and economic justice. So one part prosperity to two parts precarity, we came together to talk about how we can leverage solidarity in spite of the many efforts to keep us all apart. So solidarity, yay. As I read this, it felt like a rigorous affirmation of everything I've been screaming about for on Team Human, which is that we've been raised in this highly individualistic capitalist society, and that has both explicitly, implicitly, and structurally removed the opportunities and avenues for developing solidarity with each other to the point where it feels almost strategic. So not to get into conspiracy theory, but maybe we start there. Do you feel like there was a time, or maybe it was all the way back in ancient Greece when they stopped Socrates from conspiring, breathing together with his students? Have authorities understood that solidarity is their enemy? And do you see, as you walk around in life and talk, like signs of intentional undermining of our possibilities of forging solidarity with each other?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we have an example in the book about the ancient Roman plebs who went out to the mountain and organized the first strike. And so I think this does go back for many centuries. Just there's power in numbers, power in collective action, and that is threatening because it can transform the status quo. So it's a power that we need to acknowledge and to grab onto and to participate in. But we do constantly then face divide and conquer tactics. You know, the fact that solidarity strikes are illegal.
Are they illegal here in America?
Yeah.
I didn't know that. I thought we're always allowed to strike.
Secondary strikes, solidarity strikes are not legal.
So in other words, so that means like if like there were bakers on strike somewhere because there were machines that were cutting off their fingers and they go on strike, then I as a teacher can't say we are in solidarity with the bakers who are having their fingers cut off. We can't go on strike with them.
Yeah, there's no legal protection for that. Right now, we're seeing solidarity strikes right now happening in Sweden, where Swedish mechanics are on strike against Tesla. And there are a lot of solidarity strikes happening. The Finnish and Norwegian dock workers have decided to stop unloading Teslas. Postal workers have stopped delivering Tesla license plates. But that would not be allowed in the United States. The United States has very strict laws around union organizing, and solidarity strikes are not illegal.
So then we could never have like a general strike in America then, I guess.
And we could, but it wouldn't be approved by U.S. labor law, you know, and I think U.S. labor law provides bare minimum protections for organizing, but is also very anti-labor and does inhibit solidarity in lots of ways that we discuss in the book. I mean, to your point about there being a conspiracy against solidarity, I think there absolutely is. And that's not conspiratorial in the negative sense to acknowledge it. I mean, even the name of your podcast, Team Human, implies a team anti-human, right? What that team anti-human is doing, in our view, is trying to divide and conquer. That's the phrase Leah used. We use it a lot in the book. Trying to separate us, pit us against each other in order for a minority of people to accumulate unjust and obscene power and profits. You've written many books. There's always the period where you're brainstorming subtitles. And, you know, one idea we played with was something that would have the phrase "the most dangerous idea" in it, right? Solidarity, an account of a dangerous idea. And it, because it is an idea that is very threatening. This idea that people will come together, recognize their common interests, see their fates as intertwined, and F shit up, right? Like that they will fight together to change the status quo. This is threatening to a lot of elites. And so there's one chapter that just details just some of the ways that solidarity is being sort of suppressed or sabotaged or outright criminalized in this country. Labor law is part of that story, but not all of it. And we share that account just because we think it's so important to actually recognize that we're actually not fighting on fair terrain, right? This is actually terrain that's very hostile to solidarity. And we actually begin the book with an account of an attack on solidarity as opposed to a sort of warm and fuzzy story of solidarity.
Right.
The Southern strategy, which pitted white people against people of color in the South, this we begin in the Nixon administration, though it goes much further back to Reconstruction and before. But other more recent examples are the criminalization of people who try to help migrants. There's also an example in Georgia right now. There's been a lot of protests around Cop City, the building of this police campus. And if you try to a lot of people have gone to jail protesting this. And if you try to bail more than three people out, that's no longer allowed. That is just straight up an attack on solidarity.
Right. I mean, the interesting thing is, I mean, this supports it. I feel like one of the things you're trying to do is suggest that solidarity is not like a noun, but it's a verb. So it's not like this perfect state. Oh, we've achieved solidarity, but rather solidarity is this ongoing process that solidarity, and I hate to use a word like struggle, but solidarity is the struggle, right? It's this thing. And for me, you know, the thing I've been talking and writing about lately is trying to move away.
and I don't know if you agree with this or not, but kind of to move away from a certain kind of movement politics that kind of puts an eye on the prize, a goal on the top of the hill, and let's go and get to that in this sort of ends justifies the means journey to a thing. And I'm trying to think of it way more in terms of almost rather than movement politics, like moment politics. What are you doing right now? How are you leaning towards something? And what is the process that you're using? I mean, so in a sense, you know, solidarity as a means to an end is in some ways a booby prize. It's like solidarity is itself the thing. I mean, it's itself what we are working on, right?
So we're very clear going to the introduction that solidarity is a means and an end.
Right.
That it's both, that solidarity is the means by which we build the power to achieve our purpose, which is a more solidaristic society.
Right.
Right. And that itself is something that's not just going to be set in stone. So we're very clear that what solidarity has to be made and remade, generated and regenerated. And there are ways we could set up our society that would be more conducive to solidarity, less inclined to sabotage it, to divide and conquer us. But that absolutely, this is something that is always in flux, is not just achieved and then, oh, we can rest on our laurels. But I think the means and the ends thing is important. I mean, Leah and I are both organizers, right? We write, but we also really try to do. And so we're trying to build solidarity every day. Me and my work with debtors at the Debt Collective, Leah through her various initiatives, organizing people who are inheritors of wealth and organizing people in the political process. And so that is a project of this moment, building solidarity relationship by relationship in the here and now. But I think if we don't have a vision, and this is something we talk about in the chapter on organizing a strategy, if you don't have a vision that you're fighting for, actually, it's really hard to mobilize people to keep them engaged. And the vision we think we should be fighting for is a society actually that just really names solidarity as a core principle, instead of having it just be a word we toss around. That
right.
Solidarity should be right there with freedom, with equality, with justice, with democracy. It's something we're actually really actively trying to cultivate.
I mean, and it was kind of there. The founders kind of got it, you know, the right to gather, you know, they sort of understood that there's the people got to be able to be with each other, engage. And then, you know, I mean, for me, I look at the architecture of America and well-meaning, you know, I've talked about this before, but, you know, in a well-meaning way, Franklin Delano Roosevelt was worried about the soldiers coming back from World War II and gathering and drinking and protesting and all. And they, you know, you see the letters from the Leavitt brothers to Franklin Delano Roosevelt saying, oh, look, Levittown is going to keep the houses apart. There's no place for the men to gather. They're going to have to. So it's like, oh, wow. So carousing was an early form of solidarity, I guess. But, you know, carousing, union organizing, men gathering is like the enemy of, well, it was, at least it was systematically prevented. It's like almost like a form of redlining.
So we talk actually about spatial segregation, spatial right. separation, right? Because it's not always segregation in law. It can be sort of de facto or just built into the environment, as you're saying, as actually, you know, one of the means by which solidarity is suppressed or sabotaged in our society. Because it's true, like we need to be able to be together and carouse. And, you know, we can do that in some ways virtually now, which is great. I mean, we're here assembled over the internet, the three of us, and that's nice. But contact is key. Right. And so where that contact is undermined is it makes solidarity harder to build for sure. So, you know, I think the built environment is absolutely a space of solidarity or its absence. And so when we start thinking in our utopian way, which we can do on Team Human, it's like, wow, what would it be like to build the environment with solidarity in mind? You know, I think of public transit, right? Of just being able to be on efficient, beautiful trains where it's, you know, where you're with your fellow people and you can have that contact, you know, schools that are actually not failing, but flourishing, where people are integrated, right? Spaces where we want to be together and where we are less isolated. I think those are parts of there, you know, it's not the whole plan, but it's part of the plan of building solidarity and institutionalizing it, which is a phrase we use a lot. We think solidarity can be actually institutionalized, encouraged at that level.
And if I can, that it also takes us back to the the history of the concept, because you were talking about in America where, you know, this concept has been around a little bit, but it was much more prominent in the French literature and French history, the idea of liberty, equality, and fraternity being the French motto of the revolution. And in the literature, you can see over the course of the 1800s, fraternity sort of gets swapped out for the notion of solidarity. And our thesis is that partly has to do with the women's rights movement, and also the idea that the nation isn't just a band of brothers, it is a pluralistic entity. So solidarity becomes more and more prominent in the discourse. And there even is a political party called the Solidarists who are saying solidarity is the answer. And, you know, it was at the time where there were a lot of debates between the socialist conceptions of the state and the free market, laissez-faire. So some of these people were saying, what if, like, solidarity is the concept that can unite the individual and the collective and form this bridge? And for them, they saw economic justice being really key to solidarity. So some of them were saying we need to have an inheritance, abolish inheritance, antitrust, build worker cooperatives, create a strong social insurance and public healthcare systems. So all of that was kind of developed in under the rubric of a society that, like, put solidarity at the core.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny, because I've been playing with the phrase lately, and it feels like what I would have used as a subtitle for your book, and I you wouldn't like it, I'm sure. But what I was thinking of was, like, putting the social back into socialism. Because what the message is, because of where I'm at right now in my own journey, what I kept getting from reading the book was there's all of these isms, these abstracted isms that we've gone for over the last couple of hundred years. And even the good isms distract us from the people. You know what I mean? You get this idea, oh, here's the economic abstractivist, anarchist, syndicalist, blah, blah, blah. You know, and it's like, great idea, Doug. Hello, you know, and it's like, but it's back. So it's like putting the social back into socialism is like the solidarity was what mattered in some ways more than anything else. They got distracted. Oh, we're going to build a Politburo and it's going to administrate everything. It's like, no. It was people actually when they meet, there is, I feel like when people are in solidarity, even complex mechanisms for mutual aid emerge seemingly spontaneously out of those social interactions, that it's almost a more natural state. Not that you don't need smart people and mathematicians and spreadsheets or whatever they do, but do you know what I mean? It's like an example after example. It's like, oh, let's just engender kindness. Let's engender mutual aid and see what happens.
So I like that subtitle. I think that our editors would not have liked it. or our book publisher, right? They'd be like, okay, you're trying
right.
to
socialist. Really unique oh, no. here.
You know, I'm a proud democratic socialist, but I also in my work want to provoke.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Provoke those of us who are to say socialism isn't just a word we can toss around and be like, that solves everything. Oh, okay. We just need democratic socialism. I mean, it's just a word, right?
You know,
the question is, how do we create those connections between people. And I think I think naming solidarity is something that actually we have to really actively construct. So it does sometimes emerge spontaneously. So we quote the great organizer, Jane McAlevey, who says, you know, solidarity can emerge spontaneously in like a flood or a fire where people save each other. But then there's this other kind of consciously constructed solidarity, right? Where you're trying to build those bonds, build those bridges across difference and hold people together. And socialists have to really think about this, right? What happens after the revolution? Like, how do you actually keep people connected, keep people caring about each other, keep people compassionate? Solidarity won't stop. It's something we're going to have to keep, again, remaking and remaking, re-engendering.
Well, people get lazy. It's weird. And you guys talk about this, you know, that solidarity is this process, not a position. But what triggers solidarity most often, or something like solidarity, is a common enemy. And it's like, oh, you know, but that's the same as in a cult. Like you go, oh, you know, the Christians are suppressing us, or the you know, no one knows that we are God. So you create this, you know, and it works, you know, when you've got the Romans, you know, coming down on you. The Jews or the Christians will get solidarity really fast with each other. But it's hard, particularly, and this is almost what I'm and I know you actually wrote about it in the book too. I mean, when you're part of the privileged class, calling for solidarity is very different. Do you know what I mean? Than when you're, you know, oppressed enslaved people, you know, well, it's hard for them too, but they have a natural enemy. And it's like when you're part of, as we all are to some extent, when you're part of the colonial classes, then it's like, it's a little bit trickier to say, so how do we now, what's our call to solidarity?
Astra and I met back during Occupy Wall Street, and Occupy had this great framing of the 99% versus the 1%. And I think we still believe that there's a lot to that framing, that the 99% has a lot in common. And there are real opponents, and it is important to organize around them. You know, like Exxon suppressed information about climate change for decades. Like, that is a problem, and that is an opponent. And, you know, more recently, we're seeing people organize against, as part of the backlash to the racial justice movement over the past decade, people like Elon Musk or Bill Ackman just targeting DEI and targeting Black women in particular. And I mean, so there are opponents. Like, we don't actually, we do think that an us does involve a them. And we do say that there is a difference between what we call transformative solidarity to reactionary solidarity, where reactionary solidarity is kind of based on a shared identity and sees the them as a group that is to be annihilated or overcome, whereas transformative solidarity has a goal of the other is your positionally your opponent, but can be transformed, can be persuaded, and is not to be annihilated, but we are looking to, you know, to transform the situation. So that's where we see the difference between the kind of us-them structure or dynamic. But we do believe that that polarization is justified. We just have to like choose the right enemy.
Right. Because too often the polarization, it's the people at the top create polarization between the two. So it's like what's been top of mind for me is the polarization of Arabs and Jews in Palestine. You know, and before 1948, Jews and Arabs were all Palestinians. Right. Jews were Palestinian because anyone who was in Palestine was a Palestinian. And it's like slowly but surely these two groups are put it this way. I'm a supporter of like a land for all and standing together. And these groups of Palestinian and Israeli and Arab and Jewish activists on the ground who are trying to forge solidarity against their mutually corrupt, I won't use a word like evil, but let's just call them evil leaderships. And it's very hard for them to do that when even many of us in America see it, those two groups, as necessarily in conflict and are trying to pick one or the other, when they're begging us to help them forge solidarity rather than inflame the struggle between them. So it's like, it's so many times the people that we think are our enemy are the ones we should be in solidarity with.
Absolutely. I mean, we totally agree. And, you know, I think right now, what you have in the state of Israel is a machine that's generating reactionary solidarity, right? That thrives on this idea of an us versus them that is, you know, Israeli versus Palestinian. And Netanyahu wins, right? When people are divided and conquered like that. We see that in the antics at the U.S. border right now, right? Where, you know, immigrants are being blamed for all of the woes of American people, you know, as though it's their fault that wages are not keeping up with inflation and that the price of housing is going up. It's like, no, that is not there. You know, this is divide and conquer.
And nobody gets the facts on the ground. The facts are so good for the side of solidarity. So when you look at, oh, there are more corporate owned vacant homes in the United States than there are people who want homes, plus of so-called illegal immigrants, right? There's still going to be another 5 or 10% leftover homes. So it's like, what? You know, it's like, oh, they're stealing our jobs. Unemployment is actually at a 96 and a half year low or something like that. It's like, okay. So if the facts aren't there, but boy, the media machine, the fantasy empire is really good at forging fake solidarity.
Right. And they're, you know, and attacking real transformative solidarity. And that is their goal. That's the the absolute agenda of this, the sort of mainstream media machine. And, you know, and for most, unfortunately, a whole bunch of political and economic elites in this country. But there is also a lot of transformative solidarity happening. I mean, the streets are full of diverse community, you know, Jews and Palestinians and people who don't fit into either of those categories, calling for a ceasefire, building that solidarity in the streets. And so, and it just shows that it's possible, but also that it has to be organized into being. We have to work at it. We have to keep connecting with each other because the stakes are so high, right? The stakes are existential because, as Leah said, that reactionary solidarity is about the annihilation of the opponent. It is team anti-human.
Right. But the thing about real solidarity is then it's like, it's framed as a problem, but it's like, well, where does it stop? You know, it's like, you seriously, once you start, it's like, well, then why aren't I in solidarity with these ones and those ones and these ones and those ones? It's the thing at the time, I'm a little bit older than you, but I was like part of WTO protests in Seattle. I don't know if that was like 94, 95. I forgot when that was. And it was confusing to the news because there were all these different groups. I was there with the environmentalists, but then there were these labor people. Then there was like global justice people. Then there was women's rights people. Then there was immigration people. And we're all in solidarity against this sort of abstract extraction of value and separation of people, destruction of the environment. It was the same globalist corporations doing it. And they're meeting at the World Economic Forum in Davos is them meeting to figure out how to do it more and worse. So we're all in solidarity against that. And the news is like, well, they don't know what they're for. They don't know. Mm-hmm. It's like,
the media was like, look at these people wanting their 60s flashback fix. Remember Tom Friedman just being like these nostalgic, out of date weirdos? Yes.
And the same with Occupy, that it's like before we had the specific demands, which I still don't know that we should have, before the list of demands was there, it was like they couldn't get it. They're like, what is this?
Yeah, it's the saying that it's easier to imagine the end of the world than the end of capitalism. Right. Under our system, you know, we do live in a kind of zero sum system that pits us against each other, but there are alternatives. And so, you know, we talk about the global justice movement and the ultra-globalization vision of that. And before that, the NEO, the New International Economic Order that was proposed by a lot of states in Africa and Asia that were achieving independence after post-colonialism, that had a very specific, concrete vision of what an international order could look like that was solidaristic and that was fair and where people had, other states had more sovereignty and rights to their own resources. And it would have been a more sustainable international system than the one that we have. So there are alternative visions. And, you know, as there are for Israel, Palestine, land for all is a beautiful vision, but people get so stuck in what is. And there always is space for creativity and imagination and creating new visions. And I think that's like the beauty of these movements. And, you know, the world often sees them as antagonistic or as just saying no to what is. But there have been a lot of proposals for other ways that we can organize ourselves. So we actually propose the solidarity state is part of our constructive proposal in this book. There's often this debate about the neoliberal state versus the welfare state, kind of as the two models that dominate contemporary discourse. And you know, both of those are centuries old visions. And so we've been thinking about what could we come up with? What's new? And so we proposed this idea of the solidarity state as like a development on the welfare state. And just to open up a conversation about how else could we think about structuring our society in a way that would foster more social solidarity.
And then what's like the theory of change to get, if there one, to get to a solidarity state?
Solidarity, the means and the end. That's it, right? So solidarity is our power and it's our purpose. So it is what actually gives us the power to win things, and it's what we're fighting for. You know, so the answer, another way of saying that is the answer is organizing. And so again, you know, Leah and I spend a lot of our waking hours organizing people and trying to change things. So we are not Pollyanna-ish or naive about how hard this is. You know, I've been more working to build people power, economic power, again, through the Debt Collective, which is the world's first union of debtors. Leah has been involved at a very high level with, you know, democratic politics, with elections and stuff. And if we want to be able to resist the, you know, forces of reaction, and also the sort of corporate status quo centrist Democrats, we're going to have to get a lot more people involved and involved in a deep way. So we have a chapter called The Power of Numbers that is actually just on some level is kind of history of organizing and some advice. And so we say, you know, a successful movement has to build solidarity, and that is, happens through having numbers. But not just sheer numbers, but organized numbers, right? Like it's better to have 1,000 organized people than 50,000 names on a change.org petition.
Or 10 million names on a blue state database. I mean, centrist Democrat organizing is not organizing. It's marketing, right? It's and you all get them, right? Because I'm on all the lists. I get the emails from, I'm Joe and I'm fighting for you.
Yes.
Yeah, I know. And it's like, because they want, and what do they want? They want money is the way I'm supposed to then participate in. I mean, and I get it. They need money because they want to send out more emails. But finally, it's not, it's dealing with us individually through our email accounts rather than giving us opportunities to find each other. And not to say something nice about Trump or the red state people, but they're going to big things. They're experiencing something like solidarity at a convention.
They're experiencing reactionary solidarity. So this was a point Leah made, and I remember really being grateful you put this in the book, but that the Trump campaign had spent a lot on things like hats and merch and t-shirts, as opposed to just the texting kind of stuff that you're talking about, because it created this group cohesion, this group identity, this visceral sense of reactionary solidarity with your fellow Trump supporters. So that brings us to another thing. So successful movements need to have organized numbers, you know, and truly actually organized, a sense of identity, but one that is, you know, connects you to a larger and larger group, right? So many successful movements. So we look, for example, at the history of the disability justice movement, how that identity was actually made. I mean, disabled people didn't just see themselves spontaneously as part of the same group, right? That was something that had to be really forged. Same with workers. Mm. The working class didn't just pop into being when capitalism emerged. Workers had to forge solidarity across the trades over decades and centuries. We're still trying to build, you know, a worker solidarity instead of worker competition. So this identity is key. And then strategy, like what are the levers of power? What can you actually reach? You know, when do you engage in elections? When do you strike? When do you engage in kind of media warfare? I mean, these are questions that movements have to think about, and we have to be really serious about if we're going to, you know, change power at the level of the state, which we have to do.
Right. Because I feel, I mean, you had this great quote from Hannah Arendt about how totalitarianism is a form of organized loneliness, which I hadn't heard that, or at least hadn't heard it in a way that made me remember it, you know, in whatever other context someone might have said it, and that real democracy is organized remembrance. But I feel like we are in organized loneliness, and it may be totalitarian, but I feel like it's neoliberalism is organized loneliness. That the centrist Democratic action is, or central Democratic marketing is a form of organized loneliness. And certainly, COVID was a form of disorganized loneliness that amplified it all. But it laid bare the process by even the institutions I've thought of as the good guys are using ever more granular understandings of identity to shout out or call out, oh, I like you, you Jewish New Yorkers, go for it, whatever their algorithm found out that I am, and it's even that is against solidarity.
Yeah, I think very much so. The organization that I co-founded with Tori Gavito and Jen Ancona called Way to Win is an attempt to intervene in that democratic politics process of treating people as consumers and as ATMs, and instead focuses on trying to build up the real democratic infrastructure that we do have in every state in this country, every city in this country. There are grassroots organizations everywhere doing amazing work. They don't get that money that you give to the Biden campaign. There have to be other channels to kind of find them and to support them. Like Astra said, in part, our book is a real just invitation to get back involved in the, resist the text. You can delete the texts that you're getting from the DCCC, but get involved locally and do participate because it's fulfilling and it's what democracy needs.
Yeah. I mean, because it's interesting. So many of the very well-meaning Zoom calls I get on, our side even, keeps getting to, and you call it, and I like it, instrumentalizing others. Because the only way I was able to say it is whenever I hear them say, well, how do we get people to dot, dot, dot? How do we get people to do this? How do we get more people to? And I'm like, and it always bothered me because it felt kind of techno-solutionist, top-down. How do you get them to do it? Because you know better than they do. You want to get them to blank. And what more precisely, though, you call it, instrumentalizing others, which is still not solidarity. It's still that kind of subject-object relationship to the people that you should be with.
Yeah, I think we really are Team Human in that sense, right? I mean, we kind of end the book with a call to think about the sacred. And part of this is inspired by the French sociologist Emile Durkheim, who was sort of one of the big thinkers to actually put solidarity on the intellectual agenda. He really, anyone who's taken a sociology 101 course will have learned about him. Solidarity was really something he and the solidarists who Leah mentioned were thinking about. This is the sort of height of the industrial revolution. And there's this question, on people's minds, sort of what holds society together in this period of tumult? And so, what holds society together, when we're not just living under feudalism and you're told what to do, when the church doesn't rule every aspect of your life. And towards the end of his career, Durkheim, said, oh, society actually needs a concept of the sacred. And it can be secular, but a sense of sort of a shared sense of what really matters, what has value. And in our view, life is sacred. Other people are sacred. You don't instrumentalize them, right? You don't annihilate them. Like, these are not the politics that we aspire to. I'm coming back in my mind. I hope you don't mind if we return to this idea that you said Please. That neoliberalism is organized loneliness. And I think that it's easy in this moment, it's important to focus on the threat of Trump and the Republican Party and, the prospect of fascism. I think that's all extremely serious. But to understand how we got here, where there is this sort of vacuum and we have to say something like, hey, life is sacred. Part of that that has to do with the neoliberal project of the last 50 years, which was all about instrumentalizing things. It was all about reducing value to numbers on a spreadsheet. It was all about making space for the market to rule and insulating the market from democratic input, right? And just treating people not as people, but as sort of, again, figures on a spreadsheet, as bits to be managed. And maybe some people did that in good faith, sort of advanced that view and thought, okay, we're going to have order. We're going to have efficiency. Yeah. We're going to have goods delivered on time. But what happens when you undermine solidarity in that way, it's really dangerous because then who's there to protect anything good? who's there to stand up against authoritarianism, right? Who's there?
Right. Well, and who's there to protect, and any commons, you know, gets ignored as well, you know, because these are things the market doesn't think about. But where it goes is like Jeremy Bentham, for people who don't know, sort of a utilitarian philosopher who meant very well, right, to just use math and sort of distribute everything in a good way. But sort of Jeremy Bentham on digital LSD becomes SBF, it becomes Sam Bankman Fried, and who meets, and you tell the story, who meets up with this, you know, Oxford philosopher grifter, McCaskill, who's got this like fucking beautiful rationalization for any uber wealthy person to say, and this is the idea of long-termism, that you don't have to do any good in the world. Just earn as much money as you can and give some of it back to charity, and you'll do more good in the long run than if you were doing good. So don't even worry about it. And guys like Sam Bankman-Fried, who are not just because they're on the spectrum or anything, but just in love with abstraction, with getting away from people and eye contact and solidarity and the mushiness of social reality and a level above or a level above that. You know, so you've got capitalism, you've got digital capitalism, you've got, you know, AI capitalism, you got all these ways of abstracting yourself out of reality. They end up mathematically and technologically justifying a very extreme form of the instrumentalization or the desanctification of other human beings, where you get to the place where humanity is in the larval stage. They're all going to die. And mathematically it works, because just 8 or 9 billion people suffering doesn't matter compared to 100 trillion post-human artificial entities throughout the universe. Therefore, I am doing good.
You laid it out really well. Yeah, exactly. William McCaskill and Peter Singer, who, you know, again, I think had good intentions to say, you know, every life has equal value, but it has gotten twisted. And this basically movement within philanthropy called effective altruism has taken off, especially in Silicon Valley, where I believe people want to contribute, want to make a positive impact on the world. But when you rely just on data and abstraction, like you said, it can justify a lot of things. And, you know, so EA, one of the things it also promotes is like mosquito nets, send mosquito nets to countries in Africa. And, you know, there's evidence that those mosquito nets were being used for fishing. And then there was like overfishing. And it just, when you don't actually have relationships with people whose lives you're trying to impact, I mean, first of all, like, look at the way you're already impacting their lives. What are the power dynamics that are already in place that have made you so wealthy and other people so poor? What systems are you already complicit in? And maybe you can change those systems as an American. Maybe you can have an impact on American foreign policy that continues to extract resources from these other countries, rather than this kind of, you know, shallow effort to just send mosquito nets, which, as you said, they then justify making exorbitant wealth by saying, well, the means justify the means.
Right.
So as long as I'm sending the mosquito nets, I can scam people out of their life savings. And, you know, in these ways that Sam Bankman-Fried really epitomized.
Well, that you are living an extreme form of what almost anybody with a power book or a MacBook is experiencing, which is, you know, we are wealthy, right? We are wealthy. And it's funny, because most of the people I speak to are wealthier than me, and they laugh when I say this, but it's like, I got a few hundred thousand dollars. I mean, a few hundred thousand dollars. That's real wealth, right? That's real. I see it as wealth. It's what I will live on later. And it's in like TIAA CREF, this retirement fund for teachers, and sitting in a friggin' S&P index fund. And I often wonder, does a few hundred thousand dollars sitting in an S&P index fund do more actual damage to the world than all of the writing and shouting and other things I'm doing? And I often ask in the groups I'm in, and say, what could we do? And they'd be like, oh, don't worry about that. I was just, you remember, with the IFTF, the Institute for the Future people on this equity panel saying, don't we do this? Can't we do that? And it was, oh, nothing will work. There's really nothing you can do. Don't worry about that. But as an inheritor of wealth, how do you work with, I mean, what have you learned to teach the rest of us who are thinking there's got to be, I've got to be able to position myself differently. I have leverage. There's money that's sitting somewhere that could be sitting somewhere else, right?
Yeah. So as you indicated, I come from a family that my grandfather started an oil company. And so my mom inherited a lot of those resources and used them to support the women's movement. And I have always been passionate about economic inequality and how we can actually like get at basically growing up in philanthropy. I saw that even philanthropy is a system with a lot of power dynamics and that we need to get at the root of that inequality if we really want to have a society that doesn't involve domination, even charitable domination. And I think I am motivated by a sense of complicity. I do think we're all complicit. The New Yorker did a profile on me recently, and I kept trying to say that, you know, the reporter was fantastic, Andrew Morantz, and he said, you know, you're in such a unique position being from this oil company and caring about climate change. And I do believe that is a unique position, but like you said, we're actually all in that position. We're all inherit, like, as you said, we are a wealthy country and we're all complicit in the policies of our country and the history that we've inherited. And I don't think of complicity as a negative thing or something to be ashamed of, but, you know, we should have a sense of responsibility and gratitude that, you know, gratitude of about what we've inherited from previous generations and responsibility towards future generations. And how do we leave the world in a better place than we found it, basically? And to me, that's about getting at the distribution of power and of power and wealth and each doing what we can to redistribute that power.
Right. I mean, and partly that has to do with this sort of sacred solidarity that you're talking about. I know I'm not going to throw around a term like indigenous, but on a certain level, everybody's indigenous, right? We're all earthlings, at least. You know, we're all earthlings, and corporations and algorithms are not. They're alien entities, you know, and sort of once we can kind of reclaim some of our own sanctity, you know, it's like you've got, I hate to say charity begins at home, but you've got to see yourself as a sacred being in order to be able to look into someone else's eyes and see them as sacred too. That you have everyone has a right to be here. Everyone has a right to the same air and food and breath, but everyone deserves to be, I mean, this sounds really idealistic, but everyone's existence itself deserves to be celebrated. You made it here. That should be, you know what I mean? That should be cause for celebration rather than whatever. But you know, I have to take up the other thing you talk about in that chapter. I've got to learn radical patience. And it's really hard when things are as frustrating as they are right now, when we don't even see, many of us don't even see the other as human, much less as sacred.
Yeah. And thinking about what you just said about, you know, we all deserve to be here. And you're like, oh, that sounds really idealistic. And it's like, no, that's just a fact. Right. Let's just take that as that's like factual to me. You know, to build on what Leah was saying about we're all culpable. I mean, obviously we don't want to collapse our differences, right? I mean, it is very different speaking from North America as a Canadian American than it would be speaking from, you know, Jamaica, right? Or a country that, you know, has been divested of its wealth through colonization. But I think, I want to just build on Leah's point that, you know, complicity is not a bad thing, right? Because no person is an island. None of us are separate. We're all bound to supply chains that reach beyond the borders of our country. We are breathing the same air. That's the thing. We are all connected. And so one thing, when we go back to the history of solidarity, we trace it. One reason we draw on the thinking of Durkheim and the other people who are part of the Solidarist movement is because they actually saw solidarity fundamentally as a recognition of our mutual indebtedness, right? Of the ways that we are actually beings in time. So you know, we could see ourselves as, use the word indigenous, right? We're all earthlings, but we're also all kind of visitors here. We just kind of pop through. Mm. And there's all this stuff that happened before us that got us to this point. You know, language, I didn't invent English. I sure benefit from it. All this whole treasure trove of knowledge, of science, of innovation, of culture, of community. And hopefully that will persist and evolve for generations to come. And so they had this sense of indebtedness through time, across time. And so they thought of solidarity as a way of paying our debt to what came before us, to pay it forward. And they were like, and one way you can do that is through taxes and investing in the welfare state, you know, and taking care of other people. Right. But I think that sense of we're all bound and to a degree complicit and hopefully responsible to each other. And that, you know, depending on where we sit, we might be called on to do more, and we might have the ability and the power to do more, you know, and if so, then that's a good thing. And I the last thing I'll say is that, you know, we tell it, it's sort of this dual history of solidarity. So when is this intellectual tradition of these sociologists and philosophers in France who were, you know, privileged folks, and they were trying to appeal to people of their class and to say, hey, we have the power of the state. Hey, other privileged people, let's be in solidarity, because you know what? It's good for us too, even though we are upper class, like we live in society. Let's pay it forward.
Right.
And then there's the sort of more working class solidarity from below. If the ruling class isn't going to let us live, we're going to fight them. And, you know, we kind of draw on both intellectual and political trajectories. But ultimately, I think even folks with privilege have a lot to learn and a lot about solidarity, but also a lot to gain from a more solidaristic approach to life on Earth.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I always try to tell this even to people who want to make money. It's like, do you want to have bulletproof windows on your limousine as you're getting home? Or would you like to walk home and have everybody love you and shake your hand and be happy that your company's in their town? It's like, well, that would never happen. Of course it won't happen because you're fucking everybody over. It's like, it's so the sort of the family business. You live where you work, don't shit where you eat, because the fact is, if you're shitting, you're shitting where you eat. Because this planet is small and your shit, your poop spreads, you know? So the people that made Teflon and hid its dangers from the world, their children still have Teflon in them. You know, it's like, it doesn't go away. It's just so hard. And that's the billionaire people that I spoke with are the ones who really think they can get away. They really think they can build a bunker or get on another planet or upload their consciousness, that there's some way away from the others.
Well, I think about you every time I read about the bunkers, you know, and just think about Mark Zuckerberg's new Hawaii bunker. And you imagine a movie set there. It's not a happy movie. It's a horror movie. It's only the site of a potential horror movie. And so it's like, if that's the end you're working towards, I mean, you're right. I mean, there isn't anything that's more emblematic of an anti-solidarity approach to life, right? Than to think, wow, when the apocalypse comes, it's going to be me and my servants, you know, and my family, riding this nightmare out.
And it's like, and I win.
You know, yeah, so you're the last man standing on a burnt planet. So the rest of us need to say no and say yes to something very different.
And do you, I mean, as we wrap up here, the ending of your book reminds me a lot of Team Human, and that, you know, I kind of tried to, it's a rallying cry. We can do this. Establish rapport, knock on someone's door, borrow a drill, share stuff. It's fun. It's easy. And it's the small incremental steps that will lead to a, you know, to us seeing ourselves, to remembering that being human is a team sport, you know, find the others. But I feel like secretly, maybe, and then COVID happened, and then Middle East happened, and then Trump looks like he's coming back in one way or another. I get concerned that, I don't want to talk about winning and losing. I'm concerned about the probabilities for us to be able to forge what we know is necessary for our mutual survival.
I think it's really important to stay hopeful and to stay optimistic, not optimistic and not hoping for a better outcome, but working towards a better outcome, believing that we can have a better outcome, because it's not like the world just ends in 2025 or when Trump gets elected, or, you know, it's not like there's just going to be one massive flood and that's it. Like, life is going to continue for, you know, a while, at least. And to a large extent, I think we do create our own outcomes. When we believe that it's going to be bad, we don't do the work to make it good. You know, we self-realize a lot. We're powerful. And,
right.
And so, you know, I saw this as an example in 2022 midterms. There was a lot of, because I was doing electoral work then, and everyone was saying it was going to be a red wave. And we said, no, we have the duty, responsibility to ensure that there is not, to hold back the wave. And the organizers on the ground all over the country achieved that and did an amazing job and won tons of races. And I think that it's still, despite how hard, you know, it can seem so rough out there, but
yeah,
I think it always is possible. It always feels that way. And there's been, we have to remember that it's felt that way many times in the past. It felt that way during the Industrial Revolution, during world wars and the nuclear age. And so we just have, our current obstacles, and, but I think we can work together to overcome them.
Yeah. And to do it by forging solidarity is, it's so, I don't mean easy, but it is. To begin a journey to solidarity is so simple. It starts so little. It really is. Say hi to a stranger, you know, to help somebody do something, give someone a lift, mm-hmm. ask someone for a favor is almost harder these days than doing a favor for somebody. I mean, but those baby steps, they can lead to, I'm thinking, kind of a global mind shift, where we start realizing that everybody else are, no, you're not competing against all these people. These people are your, are our collective salvation is one another, you know? And once we just look, then it seems like what seems so impossible in an individualistic society is entirely easy in a solidarity society.
Yeah. And it is something, again, relationship by relationship, person to person, just like you're saying. And it, you know, it's interesting to think back to when Lee and I started writing this book, because it was the beginning of 2020. And yes, it was COVID and there was a lot of fear and uncertainty, but it was also, you know, the beginning of the huge upswell after the murder of George Floyd. And we were on a bit more of a movement high. And I, you know, and the tone of the book, I think, was chastened a bit as we worked on it. And right now we're in a moment where the backlash is gaining steam. And it is, I think it's terrifying, right? I mean, I don't want to live through what appears to be on the horizon, but it just makes the work all the more urgent, right? Like this, you know,
yeah.
It could not be more clear that solidarity is a major threat to the authoritarian agenda. You're seeing it, you know, in the passage of all these laws criminalizing solidarity, from criminalizing helping someone get an abortion to helping migrants, as Leah said, to criminalizing protest. And so this is just the work we have to do. You know, sometimes history calls, and it's definitely knocking on our door right now.
And the thing that makes it easier to sign up for is you don't really need an ideology to do it. You don't even need to read the book to do it. I mean, you should read the book anyway, but you don't need, it's like, oh, you mean it's just working with and on behalf of other people? Yeah. Oh, okay. You know what I mean? That it's that ready. Yeah. All right. I'll feel more hopeful then. Because yeah, it's like business as usual certainly won't get there. And looking at these systems and, oh, I'm going to vote for this one and that's going to make it happen. It's like, no. No one's going to do it for you. Just.
No messiahs. Yeah. No saviors, no messiahs. I mean, I end almost every talk these days that I give with a quote from Miriam Kaba, the prison abolitionist, you know, and she says, hope is a discipline. And I think in this moment, it's just so important. Hope is not, you know, something that you have naively, just like, gosh, I hope Trump doesn't win the presidency, but no, hope is a discipline. And it's something that we have to work at, you know, and we have to earn it.
Hope is a discipline, you know, and that's actually something great to end on, because what solidarity is, it's a rigorous and disciplined history and justification for something that we kind of know in our hearts, but with sometimes without the rigor, without the backstop, without knowing that, as you put it, that solidarity is not just something that happens now horizontally, but is something that's been happening over time that we can connect with. It's an arc. You know what I mean? It's a solidarity's arrow through time. It empowers us. It, you know, it gives us the agency to actually do solidarity less randomly and, you know, and intentionally.
Yep. Let's scare some people with our solidarity, yeah. You know?
All right. Yeah, exactly. Well, let's scare some institutions that people will welcome anybody. All are welcome. All are welcome. Step into the light. It's an old Poltergeist reference for people who don't know. Well, thank you, Leia. Thank you, Astra, for writing the book, for coming on Team Human, for trying out these ideas early with us. And good luck with this. But more important, good luck spreading solidarity as the idea in practice as much as the book itself.
Thank you so much, Douglas.
Thanks. Have a great day.
And thank you for being on Team Human. You can find out more about Leia Hunt Hendricks and Astra Taylor, as well as their new book, Solidarity, in our show notes, or by going to teamhuman.fm, where you can also become a supporting member of the team. Team Human is produced by Joshua Chapdelin and edited by Luke Robert Mason. I'm Douglas Rushkoff, and you've been on Team Human, our last best hope for peeps.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences, whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Hey, welcome to the Next Wave podcast. Consider us your chief AI officer in your business. My name is Matt Wolf. I have the number one YouTube channel in the AI space. I also run FutureTools.com, and I'm joined by my co-host, Nathan Lands, founder of Lore.com. We want to bring you the latest AI news and trends, show you how you can use AI in your business and personal life, and help make it super easy for you to understand and execute. We're going to equip you with the knowledge to thrive in this upcoming wave of change.